Dr. Carson, well, first, thank you very much for granting this interview and giving your time. I very much appreciate it. So, with the election of Barack Obama as the president, there was this narrative of this of him being sort of the talk of him being sort of the fulfillment of King's dream, and there was this sort of talk. Now, 4 years later, the enthusiasm has kind of given way to a lot of what it seems like a lot of cynicism and discontent. Now, do you think it was accurate to parallel Obama with Dr. King? Do you think that that was the correct thing to do at the time?
Well, I think you're asking two questions. One is about King's dream, but and the other is more about Obama. I think that Obama is playing the king role in the current time. That is, for many people in the 60s, King was the person who had all of our hopes, and for many people, he became the epitome of our dream. And I think that was a mistake. I don't think that social justice and democracy and equality come about because of a leader. It has to come from the bottom up. And I remember when Obama was elected, I spoke to a group the day before the inauguration, and I said the most important day is not the day of the inauguration, but what happens the day after the inauguration. You know, because if everyone who supported Obama kind of goes home and says, well, now we've elected him, let him do his thing, it's not going to work. And I think that's been proven out, you have, to use one example, the healthcare legislation that he was able to get through, but it was achieved without very much grassroots effort. Most of the grassroots effort was opposed to the healthcare reform. You didn't see very many examples of people without health insurance and people whose children don't have health insurance out in the streets demanding an even stronger healthcare program, which I think would have been very logical. Mm-hmm. I mean, why didn't we have, since most Americans like Medicare, why don't we have Medicare for all? You know, it seems like that would have made much more sense. It would have been easier to understand and easier to mobilize support for. Mm-hmm. But there wasn't an upsurge of demand for that. So you have a healthcare program that was really designed from the top down.
Mm-hmm. Now, I guess kind of on that same line, then you talk about how, it was dangerous to say, well, King was this one thing. And they kind of did that with Obama. So then going mm-hmm. back to talking about the legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. Why is it a natural inclination to always concentrate so much on an individual, and sort of this is where this sort of misinterpretation comes from, or is there something more there for why this misinterpretation happened?
I think it's largely that we always are looking for the individual responsible for the movement, even though logically, if we think about it or study it, we find that the individual was not responsible for the movement. We wouldn't be talking about Martin Luther King if not for Rosa Parks. She made him possible, not the other way around. So that always leads to some misconceptions about the role of the leader. It's one of the things I've argued against all of my career. I always emphasize that what King said himself, that if he had never lived, the movement still would have happened. Mm-hmm. We can't imagine a situation where African Americans would not have achieved civil rights reform. You know, that was a long-standing goal of thousands and tens of thousands of people who were demanding it. Mm-hmm. And those people would have demanded it even if King had never been born. But we do have this misconception about the great leader, the great leader who makes things happen historically, mm-hmm. makes history happen. And, maybe it's that it's hard to understand impersonal social forces. it's easier to explain them by reference to a leader. And particularly since we want to personify, we want to make it seem as if people can accomplish extraordinary things. In the United States, we have this mythology of the founding fathers, and we mistake the instruments of government for the revolution that took place. Mm-hmm. In some ways, the instruments that the founding fathers created were a reaction to the revolution, of a constraint on democracy. When we look at the Constitution in particular, it was a way of making sure that democracy was not going to be expressed in the new republic. So I think that's one prime example where we tend to mythologize these great men and forget that their true role was not only not to make a revolution, but to constrain a revolution.
Hmm. And on that note, talking about always trying to find the great leader, in the last year we saw the creation of the Occupy movement, which mm-hmm. is in effect leaderless.
And Arab Spring.
There was that
search for who was the leader of this. It's a great movement.
Because a lot of it too, it's interesting with the Occupy movement, because people say, well, what is this? I don't understand what this is. What are these people talking about, right? So from your perspective, as someone who was involved, in the civil rights movement and as a scholar, what kind of, do you see parallels with that, with the civil rights movement and the Occupy movement, and where does it diverge? What's your opinion on that?
Well, I think one of the things that's happened since the 60s is that it's easier now for movements to be sustained without charismatic leaders because of the technology that's available, that there's other ways of getting information than having a centralized leader. So that makes possible word to spread more rapidly. But even in the 60s, if you look at a phenomenon like the sit-ins, there was a movement that emerged from the grassroots, and it spread through people copying what had happened in Greensboro, North Carolina. Hearing about it on television or on the radio, and read about it in the newspaper, and try it yourself. So that shows that even then, with that technology, I can imagine now with Twitter and Facebook and a movement like the sit-ins would have just taken off even more rapidly, and it would have been much more coordinated.
Now, another thing in talking that when Obama was elected, there was also this talking of the post-racial America,
mm-hmm.
and sort of that kind of language. In light of the Martin killings that happened in Florida, what do you think this idea of this post-racial America would suddenly come up as if a black president would do it? And I mean, and especially in light of like I said, in the Martin killing that happened in Florida, was this just nothing more than wide-eyed enthusiasm, or was there something else going on there? Do you think, of why people would say something like that?
Well, I think sometimes we mistake the symptoms of progress for progress itself. That the legislation that was passed in the 60s was certainly momentous. The Civil Rights Act and Voting Rights Act and those sorts of things. But But ultimately, change towards social justice or democracy has to come from the bottom up. It has to come from people actually exercising rights, having the confidence to do that. And that's a slower process. That's much more of a cultural shift. And so what I think happened in the 60s is that we had a fairly rapid shift in terms of the legal norms, you know, because that was in a sense overdue. You know, that there was, it was difficult for me to imagine how you could have maintained the Jim Crow system. It was an anachronism within the United States, just like colonialism. I mean, colonialism was expensive to maintain, and you know that there were a lot of countries that were kind of complaining and wanting to get out of the business of being the colonizer. But they didn't want to lose control. And so they were searching for other ways of staying dominant and not squandering their wealth on, you know, policing the world, but rather exercising control in other ways. And I think that's what happened in the United States, is that if you look at the South, there was this shift from the Jim Crow system, and there was some psychic sense that, you know, I'm sure that a lot of people had an investment in segregation and formalized discrimination. But once they recognized that they had to let it go, there were other ways of exercising control. Mm-hmm. Economically, doing things that slow down change. For example, this massive shift of white voting support from the Democratic Party to the Republican Party, the most massive, rapid shift of political allegiance in American history. You know, suddenly the solid South for the Democratic Party becomes the solid South for the Republican Party. And as Johnson said at the time, it was, that was the price that he saw the Democratic Party paying. We'll lose the South for the next generation. Well, we're way beyond a generation. He might have said for the next 50, 60. It probably will not be in my lifetime when we will see a majority of white voters in the United States vote for a Democratic candidate. Hmm. It hasn't happened since 1964. The main reason why we have change is that many of the less noticed parts of what was called the Civil Rights Revolution had impacts on lots of other people. The women's rights movement, the immigration reform of the 1960s, which changed the United States demographically. Without those other changes, I mean, if it were not for the empowerment of women and the gender gap, if it were not for the fact that the American electorate has changed, it wouldn't be possible for President Obama to win with 43% of the white vote. And in the South, much lower than 40, that's his average nationwide. In Mississippi and Alabama, he got about 10% of the white vote. So clearly that, not only did that not change, it's actually become even more of a constraint on change. It's made it even more difficult for a Barack Obama to do anything. He's pretty much stalemated.
Mm-hmm. But I also wonder, I mean, with the Martin killing in Florida, I mean, you see this. I mean, it wasn't until now that finally this stuff is coming out. I mean, when you see this sort of this silence, I guess some people have said this silence from the state on these sorts of issues. Mm-hmm.
When I say that there's a constraint on the victories of the 1960s, one of the major barriers to the kind of change that we might have expected has been the criminal justice system. I mean, this is. One small example of the way in which the criminal justice system has not changed very much at all. Mm-hmm. It's still white dominated. In some parts of the country, it has a racial component. It is very much focused on keeping black people under control. You know, it has much greater impact on black people who break the law than on white people who break the law. And all of this is demonstrated statistically that for the same offense, a black person gets a longer prison term. And that's cumulative, because once you've been convicted of one thing, then the next time you even get a longer sentence. So I guess the best way of putting it, it's kind of, we've had slavery by a different name. Now when we look back at the post-slave South, now we have Jim Crow by a different name. We have different ways of achieving the same result or a similar result that are not so overt and are much harder to root out. You know, we can look at the prison population, especially for drugs, because we know statistically that white people use just as many drugs as black people, and yet you'd never know that from who goes to prison. In many instances, a white drug offender, and I know because I'm at Stanford and there's lots of white drug offenders there, and I can tell you not one of them goes to prison. And everyone knows that they use drugs. So what does that say? You know, that if you happen to be living in a ghetto and you get caught with marijuana, or you get caught with cocaine, you go and spend time in prison. If you get caught at Stanford, you may or may not get expelled. Almost the worst that can happen is your parents get called. So that includes people who sell drugs. But you know, it's not just obviously the Stanfords of the world. It's any upper middle class neighborhood. They do not treat drug offenders the way they are treated in the inner city. So this is kind of one of the ways in which we brought about a legal, formal transformation of American society, but it hasn't yet permeated the society as a whole.